Colorful radio.
Hello and welcome. If you're just joining us, you are tuned into Colorful Radio. We're coming to you from the Africa Center, broadcasting across the UK and beyond on colorfulradio.com. I am your host, Desiree Joel Adam. Now, for anyone who is even vaguely familiar with me, you will know how much I love African books, stories, and literature. I've been so fortunate to indulge in that world recently. The 2020 AKO Kane Prize for African Writing, one of the most prestigious literary awards in the world, has shortlisted five phenomenal writers for this year's award. For those of you who may not know, the AKO Kane Prize for African Writing, now in its 20th year, is a literature prize awarded to an African writer of a short story published in English. The prize was launched in 2000 to encourage and highlight the richness and diversity of African writing by bringing it to a wider audience internationally. The focus on the short story reflects the contemporary development of the African storytelling tradition. On the list is Erinison Okoji, representing Nigeria and UK for her short story, Grace Jones. Remy Ngamije, representing Rwanda and Namibia, for The Neighborhood Watch. Jowo Ile, from Nigeria, with Fisherman's Stew. Chikodili Emelumadu, from Nigeria and UK, What to Do When Your Child Brings Home a Mummy Water. And Erika Sugo Anyadike, from Tanzania, How to Marry an African President. If you haven't read any of their stories, I would recommend you do so in order to appreciate the work of these phenomenal writers. I had the pleasure of speaking to four of the five nominees in what can only be described as a masterclass for African creative writing and thought. I only had to ask one question, and it sparked a conversation that you do not want to miss.
Colorful radio.
We are talking about the AKO Kane Prize for African Writing shortlist. Remy Ngamije, Jowo Ile, Chikodili Emelumadu, and Erika Sugo Anyadike all join me for a conversation to discuss their work and the nomination. Erika's story, How to Marry an African President, is open to interpretation. As readers, we're invited in to have a dialogue and perhaps come to our own conclusions about the story. I asked her about the thought process for writing it and what she had hoped we would take away from it.
I mean, I think the story started really because I had been reading a lot of articles about Grace Mugabe, and I think I was perturbed by this one-dimensional representation of her. It really bothered me, like, here we have this woman who is this iconic representation of greed. And so for me, I start wondering about, like, why are those images being perpetuated? So why do we have that being sort of the stereotype, and there's no complexity, there's no nuance to it? So I felt like I wasn't necessarily trying to deny her excesses or whatever, but I wanted a sort of a more complex reading of her. And I wanted to kind of take the idea of this first lady and just kind of imbue it with some empathy. So that really was the genesis of the story, I think. And then also, you know, one of the things we talk about, like, as fiction writers, or rather, let me speak for myself and not speak for writers in general, is, you know, journalists are interested in the facts, they're interested in the what. And as a fiction writer, for me, I'm interested in the how and the why. So it also starts with sort of questions. So one of the questions, how does this young woman marry a man, a powerful man at that, who is 40 years her senior? And I started thinking about things like, why is she single-handedly sort of being blamed for his downfall? You know, and really trying to unpack what are the power dynamics in that situation, power dynamics between her and her husband, but also power dynamics in terms of how she was portrayed in society. And so I started thinking about certain parallels, biblical parallels between Grace and Eve, mm-hmm. and Grace and Delilah, you know, the whole story about Samson and Delilah. I started thinking about, you know, the later part of her marriage when she actually made a bid for power. And I thought about, you know, I thought about Icarus, to be honest. I thought, you know, why is it that when, particularly women, when we're ambitious, it's always seen in these really negative terms. So when we describe a man as ambitious, he's seen as a go-getter, he's seen as somebody who's, you know, really got his whole act together. But when a woman is described as ambitious, it tends to be an insult. She's, you know, it's, she's seen as calculating and controlling and cold, you know. And I was thinking around a lot of these things, and I wanted to write a story that kind of unpacked and explored that. So really, it was around what are the controlling images that are being put out there, that are being put out there about grace.
Erica's narrative of the woman who marries the African president opens the door to a conversation that is not just limited to the continent. It's a global one that speaks about the changing role of women, their representation in the media, the political sphere, and even at home, and how dynamics are slowly shifting. Chikodile Emelumadu also shared her thoughts on how in her personal life and her writing, she's unapologetic about women taking ownership and responsibility as leaders.
To pick up on Erica's point about assertive females, I think that was something that I consciously tried to, like in my day-to-day speech, present women who are normally seen as, like girls are seen as bossy boots if they're assertive, or are seen as, you know, they say, oh, she's a bit of a little madam. And I learned very quickly with my kid being in kindergarten and then going on to primary school to refer to girls who had that quality in terms of leadership and assertiveness, because they were assertive. That's all that was wrong with them. And, you know, it's a similar trait that Grace Mugabe, well, the Grace Mugabe so-called influence in Erica's story, that is also in my story with the Mami Water girls that are coming home. You know, if you look at the qualities that these girls have, it's usually girls who are assertive. It's girls who want to wear what they want to wear. It's girls who want to look you in the eye when they're talking and not kind of like have the whole crestfallen expression or like downturned eyes or whatever. And so there is a real problem with women being seen to have their own agency, and not just having their own agency, but having no sort of modesty or faux modesty surrounding their desire or their drive for that agency.
And just to add on to that, I think it's important to talk about, you know, how what Chikodile was saying is about how behavior is gendered, but more importantly, as writers, we need to think about how language is gendered. So, you know, a man will be described as assertive, but a woman who displays the same behavior will invariably be described as aggressive. And so there are nuances in language that I think we need to think about. And just to finish wrap up this particular point, I don't necessarily think that the character who inspired my story, Grace Mugabe, to be frank, to be honest, I don't necessarily think that she deserved the presidency, but you know, I also don't think a lot of men deserve the presidency, right? That actually get it. And so the things that were important to me were really kind of saying, why is it even when somebody does make that bid for power, Grace in this particular instance, but also if you know the history of Zimbabwe, also Joyce Mujuru, who was a proper liberation struggle hero, who was, you know, in the trenches with the men.
Why is it that
languages, pardon?
She was ostracized in the end.
Yes, she was ostracized in the end. But think about, when I talk about how language is gendered, think about the insults that are leveraged at these women. So it's you know, insults that are sexualized, insults that are violent often, and also insults that are incredibly reductive. And one of the parallels that I like to draw, and I'm sure at a later stage we'll talk about, you know, certain writing style and strategy and decisions that we've made, but just, you know, to brush over it initially, one of the things that was also really important is to basically say, this isn't something that just happens on the continent, because for me, I struggle between, I'm really sensitive and conscious about representation. So I struggle between wanting to tell a particular story, but also being almost hypersensitive and hyper aware to how outside is going to read that story. And you have to let that go, because ultimately I'm writing primarily for African readers, yeah, or readers of African descent. So I sometimes have to let go of the concerns that I have about how Western readers are going to bring their own interpretations to the text. And that's not even within the realm of my control. So I've literally had to learn to live with it. But it's important for me to say that that kind of misogyny happens also within the West. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so we've seen that happen with Hillary Clinton. We've seen that happen with a lot of other leaders. And I wanted just to unpack that and to explore it and use Grace Mugabe, to be honest, as the Trojan horse, as the vehicle for some of those ideas.
As we continue to further unpack these stories and delve deeper into the characters that play an important role, I turn to Remy Ngamije, a young Rwandan-Namibian writer, to discuss The Neighborhood Watch, a story about survival on the streets of Windhoek. Knowing that we would all engage with the characters and perhaps relate to them in different ways, I wanted to know if he thought the readers owed anything to the real people upon whom he had based his characters.
Yes, we owe them primarily our first step being introspection, ourselves, the people in the houses, the people who are not on the streets, the people who create the neighborhood watches in our WhatsApp groups and police, all of the people who've been disenfranchised from society. We owe them introspection to ask ourselves how we let it get this bad and what the heck we can do, all right? So with a character like Elias, what is it that you need to take away from this story in regards to those people? Is that those people are not homeless because they chose to be, you know? They are not homeless because they failed or because they did something wrong. It's because something was taken away from them by a particular system and a particular way of life. And if we are all involved in the system, we have to ask ourselves, how did we get here? And how do we not continue being in this moment? So obviously everyone's going to have their own take and they're going to feel pity or they might feel sorry. And you know, for me, and this is something perhaps Joho and Erica and Chikadili can speak about, is that when we tell the stories, and Erica's very good at this, like she's got better words than I do, is like when we approach our craft, it's always a trick. What you think the story is about isn't actually what the story is about. You know, you're looking at the left hand, but the deceit is in the right hand. And so, you know, we're looking at Elias, but what created Elias? How did he get there? And there is the real story. You're thinking about Mami Watas, but that's not where the real story is. Like, you need to be reading the footnotes, girl. Or like, you know, if you're reading about everyone who's approached Erica, and I've had a delightful interview with her with the BBC, where everyone, you know, zeroed in the fact that it's Grace Mugabe. And I was like, fam, this could be Anne Boleyn. It actually is Anne Boleyn. Like, you know, this is how to marry a British king. So it's this thing about, like, you know, what you zero in, what your emotional reading of a story tells you might not actually be what the writer might have intended. And that's a very delightful MFA question. What was the writer's intention? Anyway. It's a question.
We
like,
wouldn't know. Some of us didn't do MFAs, Remy. Some of us. I never did one either.
I never did one either. But you know, it's a question like.
Some of us had children.
But you know, don't worry. I've also never done one of these things. I'm just trolling people. But yeah, so you're seeing the story and you're seeing Elias and you're hearing about him and his life and you know what happens. But is that really what the story is about? I think there's so many different interpretations. And for me, it's a question of like the neighborhood watch, even the name. Is it really about the neighborhood watches in the five characters? Or is it about the people who sit in their houses paranoid as heck when people come to go through their bins?
Linked to Remy's response about the sort of characters that feature in these stories, I'm drawn to Nimi, the widow in The Fisherman's Stew, written by Nigerian writer and professor Joho Ile. I began to wonder what inspired his story and what it was that he really wanted the reader to see or to understand. Like the homeless characters in Remy's The Neighborhood Watch, Joho's story puts a spotlight on another group of people, often invisible to society.
I was talking to an older woman that I still know, and she was talking about just the process, how we go through phases and how we're seen. Identity really is not really about what you are or how you see yourself, you know. It's also about how other people see you, because we live in the world, you know. She talked about the time in her life where she stopped, where she became invisible, where when people saw her, it was to either give something or, you know, they stopped seeing her as a person, as someone who was, because she was also aware of being seen as beautiful, and she was extraordinarily beautiful when she was younger, and to have that kind of power as well, because it is power, and then to see that wane and to see that her, you know, she was seen in a different way, or she was actually just invisible. And for me, that was interesting. And when I was thinking about writing this story about a character who was going to do that, that I wanted to write it from that point, from I wanted to go to that center to make a point that, because I saw her that day, and that just to make that point that even people that we don't see still have dreams and aspirations, still have hopes. They want to be what they want to be.
Even some writers, particularly those from the continent, might argue that they too are still invisible. More so, the ones who write about mysticism, occult, Greek mythology, and alternative genres. What to do when your child brings home a Mami Wata is a story in a genre that stands out to the readers not only because of its reference to ancient African culture, but also the pseudo-academic style with which this how-to guide is written. I asked Chikodili if alternative genres are still an anomaly, and what advice she had for other writers who may not necessarily feel they fit within the categories often recognized by literary awards.
I think more and more, because I used to submit to a lot of like science fiction and fantasy magazines, and more what you find is a lot of Nigerians, a lot of young Africans, are also letting people who would normally not submit because they're thinking my stuff is too strange, are beginning to break free of those chains and to write whatever it is that they want to write. And it doesn't actually stop them from writing something that is considered literary, you know, but they would write anything they want to write. And I think that's how it should be now. It should be the story is what counts. It's not about who's going to read it or whether they can understand it, you know, having to basically cut off your own nose to spite your face. A lot of people have said that this 2020 shortlist has been diverse. I mean, yeah. I'm hopeful that it will mean that a lot more people recognize that whatever you're writing, as long as you're somebody who is of African descent, whatever you're writing is valid. It's valid. Mm-hmm. If you left a lot of the writers who are African, they wouldn't write to any particular genre. They would write across genres.
For everything.
Because that's how life is. That's how our storytellings are. You know, I remember hearing this oral story about a guy who then goes into this vessel, what I would now describe as a vessel, and disappears into space. And that's like, it's an old story, you know, and I wouldn't have made the connection between it and science fiction until I was this age. But it's the same thing, you know. They're talking the same thing. You know, if it's literary in quotes, you know, but if it has supernatural elements, people just want to. And one person I know who is doing that well is probably like, oh, two people actually. There's Nekarima, Leslie Nekarima, who is doing it well, and Helen Oyeyemi, who does it well as well. You know, where you can't really say, oh, her genre, she's writing to this genre. She's just writing the same way that we tell stories on the continent. You know, it's like, and then you're there and suddenly there's a broom that is magically sweeping by itself. We accept it. You know, like, you've just been telling me a story about this woman that maybe threw her child, or you are going to the pit latrine and you heard a cry, there was a baby in there, and you ran back to get your lantern. Maybe your lantern fell over and it went out, so you were like, oh, let me go and get another lantern. And by the time you came back, there was a broom sweeping in front of the... You're not going to be like, Che, what is this story? No! You want to hear more. Right now, you want to hear more. I'm looking Absolutely. At you and you're nodding. Exactly. You want to hear, like, yeah. So what was the broom there for? Was it to sweep away the flies from the baby? Was it a sign? Is this baby special? Was it a hallucination? We don't know. But my point is, we don't tell stories to genre. You know, genre is a totally new thing. So I think, hopefully, with the fact that this shortlist has been diverse, as most people have been saying, a lot of other writers out there who think their stuff would never find a home, or what they think is too strange, or, oh, well, nobody will ever publish this, just get it out there. I mean, obviously, yeah. It still ties into the point of who is going to accept it, who is going to want to read it, but just keep sending it out and hope that somebody bites, you know? And what our job, us who have been shortlisted, what our job is to make sure that people will always find a place to land. So now anybody who has seen my work knows that Dan Coxon, you know, is an editor that will accept any kind of thing like the stuff I'm writing about. They know, and that's part of what your bio is there for. If they look at your bio and see the people who have published you, submit to them then. If you want to write, if you're writing the same kind of stuff I'm writing, submit to them and they'll publish it because it's the kind of stuff that they learn.
The stories on the shortlist for the 2020 AKO Kane Prize for African Writing are said to speak eloquently to the human condition through a diverse array of themes and genres. In the words of the chair of judges, director of the Africa Center, Kenneth Olumiyo Thab, we were energized by the enormous breadth and diversity of the stories we were presented with, all of which collectively did much to challenge the notion of the African and diaspora experience and its portrayal in fiction as being one homogeneous whole. These brilliant and surprising stories are beautifully crafted, yet they are all completely different from one another. From satire and biting humor to fiction based on nonfiction, with themes spanning political shenanigans, outcast communities, superstition and social status, loss and enduring love. Each of these shortlisted stories speak to what it is to be an African or a person of African descent at the start of the second decade of the 21st century. Together, this year's shortlisted stories signal that African literature is in robust health and, as demonstrated by the titles alone, never predictable. I ended this insightful conversation by asking each one of the writers what it meant for them to be shortlisted by the AKO Kane Prize.
What I like about the AKO Kane Prize is the consistent commitment to diversity in terms of themes, the experiments with form and style. So I'm really happy to be on this shortlist because I think it demonstrates how egalitarian that process is and hopefully how it will continue to be.
Thank you.
I mean, I've made the Kane Prize, the AKO Kane Prize, as it's called now, twice with stories that I didn't think anybody else outside the subset of African science fiction and fantasy or horror or weird stuff or fabulism would get, you know? And I'm saying all these labels, of course, because that's the labels I've learned that people apply to me, not the labels I apply to myself. So twice I've made the shortlist with these stories that were weird and bizarre and odd and, you know, but people seem to like them. It seems to resonate with the judges and in turn with our audience. And so I think that what it means to me is that there are a lot more avenues that are accepting of my niche. It's not a niche, it's not a self-imposed niche, but it's a niche nonetheless. And it just means that hopefully, I mean, this is what it means to me, okay? It means that all the weirdos out there, the people I write for, that they too can, you know, have the confidence to submit their stuff. I mean, I want to read your stuff. I don't want to just read only my stuff. You know, there are lots of us out there. I mean, recently, Pemi Aguda, she won £10,000 from the Deborah Rogers Foundation for, she writes in that same vein as well, like really odd, really weird things. So I think for the AKO Kane Prize, it just means that they'll probably get a lot more entries. People are diverse, people who write all sorts of stuff because there will now be the confidence that their work is going to be recognized. And I suppose sometimes people need that validation. We need that validation to know that we're just not alone writing to ourselves.
Thank you. Joel?
It's great to be recognized for, you know, for a story you've written. Simple, like, you know, because writing is it's a really solitary thing and you never know what a reader, even one reader, will like. Not to talk of two readers and then loads of them to be recognized for it. I just think it's you know, the novelists, writers that I love who've been connected to it and have been shortlisted or won the award. So for me, my reaction is just joy and like, hey, this is good. Let's have fun with it. You know, it's like a celebration to me.
Nice. Remy?
Being shortlisted for this prize is for the first time being recognized amongst writers whose work I've known in the past. So I've read, and after many days, I knew about How to Marry an African President last year when it was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Prize. I knew about Chikodili's work when she was shortlisted in 2017, I think, or 2018.
Mm-hmm. So yes, 2017.
When I saw the shortlist, there were people whose work I'd already seen and read, and to be recognized amongst them was like, whoa. And again, we can never underestimate what it means for someone from here, because there's never ever been someone in the country's entire history being recognized at this level. For us as a literary community, it's always like, whoa, what the heck just happened, you know? And being the first is always cool and all. And that obviously raises questions about where we're going to find the second and third. But for me, being recognized is like a win, because I'm being, in 2021, I'm being recognized amongst writers whose work I've already seen and that I knew. And then you get told, you see the shows and you're like, Jesus, wow. Like, I'm with Joho, I'm with Chikadili, I'm with Erica, I'm with the boss, Irenison. Like, I've seen, you know, for us, these are people who exist like on bookshelves and like on in literary magazines somewhere else. Vintuk is very far from literature. And so to be recognized among such people for me is still, it's still shocking, to be honest. And it's not something that I can get over. But that's literally the sentiment. You're like, what just happened?
I had such a fantastic time with these phenomenal writers, and I'm the richer person for it. I'm also excited and humbled to have been introduced to them. I'll be following their journeys and looking forward to more of their work. Congratulations from all of us at Colorful Radio, and we're wishing you all the best. If you want to find out more about the Kane Prize and these writers, go to caneprize.com.
Colorful,
colorful,
Desiree,
colorful, colorful, colorful radio.